I'm Afshin Ratansi, and welcome back to Going Underground, broadcasting all around the world from Dubai in the UAE. If you thought that last week's G7 summit was just economics child's play designed to provoke competitor giants, Russia and China, you may be looking towards this summer's BRICS summit. Who would have thought that the economic alliance BRICS, comprising Brazil, Russia, India, China and South Africa, could rise up as a serious rival to the G7? That would be the Goldman Sachs economist who famously coined the acronym BRIC over 20 years ago. Former UK Conservative Government Minister Lord Jim O'Neill joins me now from London, from a park, I think. Lord O'Neill, thank you so much for coming on. I know you sometimes despair of the fact it's the only acronym that is so famously allied to your name, with the added S, obviously. At the G7, NATO was at war with the R, the C, it seems, the Russia, China. Brazil, President Lula's been on this show, only recovering after US-backed coups against him and Dilma Rousseff. Was it some kind of target list?
Most amusing. I'm not surprised some people might think that way. You know, what a sad state of affairs. One of the only few things positively that happened on the back of global governance was the creation of the G20 after the financial crisis, which of course brought the BRICS countries in with the most developed countries and other emerging nations. And here we have the G7 in some ways trying to behave as though they still rule the world. And I'm sure for the BRICS countries, particularly China and Russia, it is going to be regarded as another adversarial provocative thing. And it's can't see how it's particularly fruitful for anybody, to be honest.
I know you've made many nuances to the idea over time. Just take us back very quickly before we get to the present day, how revolutionary your idea was, given that I think I was in Dubai in 1999 when Foreign Policy magazine, famously associated with US intelligence agencies and who knows what else, said, this is all overblown, China's finished.
So, I mean, it was 9/11 that started me on it, actually, in 2001, oddly. I was actually in one of the buildings when that tragedy took place. But on reflection, I read it perhaps strangely as a symbol that the world has kind of had enough of the Americanization of the world as we knew it. And it was against the background in how you asked the question of me being really impressed with how China played its own key role in bringing an end to the 1998 Asian financial crisis. And it led me to think we need to somehow develop a world in which different philosophies, different cultures, different political beliefs and regimes can somehow coexist, but we still have some kind of rules of engagement around the world to make the world a better place. And I find myself in explaining it there thinking, my God, we haven't really got very far in 22 years. But for a brief period with the advent of the G20, we did.
And it was qualitatively philosophical in that way, but also quantitative. Since then, we've had, just in the past few weeks, there's now been some scandal about the setting of interest rates and were they cobbled together, the famous LIBOR intra-rate scandal, with the connivance of central banks. How can we trust data? I mean, I'm going to get on to commodity prices, which I think is so important to your BRICS concept anyway. How do we trust economic indicators? I know that BRICS has surpassed, just in the past few weeks, in terms of GDP, those are the GDP of the G7. But how do we trust economic indicators?
I guess the most frank way of beginning to answer is that, you know, economics is, at the end of the day, a social science. And all it can do with data is give you a snapshot at a moment in time of what's going on anywhere based on conventional techniques.
But this was fraud, wasn't it? Alleged fraud. I'm not sure Deutsche Bank, Barclays, Citi, JP Morgan, RBS, I think some of them settled without any liability. These are, and as you mentioned, of course, so many people were saying that China was forging its data. This is about, it is a social science maybe, but measuring GDP, measuring interest rates, measuring commodity prices, looking at the manipulation. How is a future economist going to come up with a new acronym like BRICS for whatever it is, if all the data is being accused of being fraudulent?
I mean, to be honest, I think you're mixing in lots of different things with this question. There's economic data, which independent analysts are there to analyse all over the world and make opinion on, which is what I spent so long on. And then there are interest rates and other things to do with running of the financial system, which I wouldn't describe as economic data. They're financial data. And there was a system put in place that lasted for many years. But the core issue that goes to this part of your question is the regulatory regime and whether the regulators are monitoring properly loopholes that individual financial organizations or the sector in general effectively games the system for. But I don't think that's anything to do with economic data, to be honest with you.
I think the reason I'm asking is partly because of what's happening in Ukraine, actually. I know you've said that you've pondered whether Russia should have been in BRICS as you formulated it. But why is it that all the advisors and all the politicians were telling us that Russia would be finished off by sanctions, and Russia clearly hasn't? And if anything, its economy seems to be doing better than the country from where you're speaking to me from.
I think there are three things linked to why so far Russia is doing better than countries that imposed the sanctions believed. First of all, links completely with the BRICS and why other countries in the emerging market nations are currently talking about potentially becoming part of the BRICS alliance. Russia replaced a lot of its lost exports, seemingly, particularly oil and gas, to other parts of the world. And maybe India is a particularly intriguing example of a country that's put its own economic interests and needs at the heart of what it wanted to do. And that's obviously been a significant increase in a market for Russia, and lots of things obviously going on directly between Russia and China. So that's the first thing. I think the second thing is that because of what happened with prices, particularly gas prices for the first 6 months of the sanctions, it meant that the total value of stuff that Russia was getting, albeit from less conventional markets, was worth more. And so for the Russian balance of payments, there wasn't the kind of shock that perhaps some of those policymakers originally thought. And then as it relates to, on a relative basis, obviously because of the huge rise in inflation, many Western central banks have spent the whole of the last year raising interest rates dramatically, which is changed in different countries, but served to slow down the cyclical health of their economic performance as a way to try and get inflation under control. I'd throw one thing back on top of all that. You know, it's not entirely clear as you go through time whether Russia would continue to be able to cope with the persistence of sanctions, not least because, as we've just seen with this G7 meeting, despite what I said earlier, the scale of sanctions are getting tougher. And if the Western alliance really is very successful in applying sanctions on Russia's access to critical technology, then that I would guess over time that is going to start hurting Russia more than is probably currently perceived.
I mean, Gazprom, just in the past few days, the Russian operator, reporting that they've increased supplies of energy to the European Union, and similar statistics coming out about the black market. Do you believe that the US destroyed the Nord Stream pipeline? You began that whole description about energy supplies, because some people in the Global South think that G7 nations are self-sanctioning themselves. And this all amidst this that spike in energy prices that occurred because of the sanctions.
Listen, I think if you rode the clock back, policymakers might have thought differently about the kind of sanctions they were going to undertake and adopt. I had not heard that rather amusing idea of the US blowing up the Nord Stream pipeline. I can't quite imagine why they'd do that. But
well, it was Seymour Hersh who said that. Actually, The Economist did a terrifying graph, I have it here, saying that more people died 22 to 23 from the rise in energy prices, 68,000, than COVID. 68,000 people in Europe. We don't know how many people died because of cold in Europe as the self-sanctioning happened and the Nord Stream was destroyed. Those who believe Seymour Hersh's exclusive, believing that was obviously to stop Germany relying on Russian energy as opposed to imported natural gas from fracking in the United States.
I'm not aware of that report, but to be honest with you, it sounds quite fanciful to me. I've no idea what's behind that, and it doesn't really make a lot of sense.
OK, but what about this de-dollarisation, which is the big question people are asking ahead of the BRICS summit in South Africa, ahead of the G20 in India? You've said it doesn't actually matter that much, but on the other hand, does it matter a lot? Because you mentioned interest rates, US interest rates there. While they try and always keep a stable currency in the United States, they can be a virtual peg, but all the trade can be done within G20 countries outside of any kind of US control, as it were.
I've just written something about this topic again. In fact, I've done it a few times in the past 2 months because it's become such a popular theme in the run-up to the BRICS summit. And I have two very strongly contradictory views. The first of which is that eventually, as we saw in the United Kingdom, the world's most actively used currency will ultimately be that of the world's most important economies. So the idea that the dollar will remain king forever, I think, is probably unlikely.
Can you give me a timescale, though? We had Obama's special advisor on the other day, said 2060. You're usually right about things. When's it going to be?
I have no idea. I am sufficiently experienced enough in finance to say anybody that attempts to do that is close to start raving mad. And, there was a time where I was supposed to be known as the king of the foreign exchange market, and foreign exchange market has a habit of making complete idiots out of people that even think they know what they're talking about pretty quickly. But what I would say, and linked to the tone of that answer, for virtually the whole of my, I guess it's now 40 years of looking at global economic and financial affairs, this is not the first time people have talked about the end of the dollar. In fact, it happens every other year, if not with the same intensity always, and it's never happened yet. And if you look at the history of the pound sterling and its domination of world financial markets, it persisted well beyond when the UK economy started to become much smaller as a share of global GDP. And so at some point, the dollar will lose its dominant status. I do think if China and India could ever really strongly agree on things as the two biggest countries in the emerging world and the only two with more than a billion people each, then that would probably hasten the end of the dollar's dominance.
Lord Jim O'Neill, I'll stop you there. More from the Goldman Sachs asset management chairman who coined the acronym BRIC after this break. Welcome back to Going Underground. I'm still with Lord Jim O'Neill, the former Goldman Sachs asset management chairman who coined the acronym BRIC. We can't predict when exactly de-dollarization is going to manifest itself right across the world. Why do you say India has done so well? I mean, some people would say it has more poverty than the whole of sub-Saharan Africa put together. And yet you're saying that together, I mean, is it just population, that India and China, them making friends, something that there are people in Washington arguably trying to prevent. Why would that be so important?
Well, because if you look at how the shape of the world economy has shifted since the BRICS idea, China has obviously, at least until recently, been spectacularly successful. And I think you touched on it earlier. Because of that, in purchasing power parity terms, the BRICS share of GDP is now stronger than that of the G7. But in dollar terms,
I think it's not even China, PPP. I think it's 31.5% for BRICS and G7, 30.7 as of March.
I don't think it's the case in nominal dollars because of what's happened to the Russian ruble and the Brazilian real. Actually, their economies measured in dollars are much weaker in total size than the world.
I think those are the figures. Indeed.
Right, but the reason why, what I'm going to go on to say is because of China and India. Those two have become more and more relevant economically, not just inside the BRICS, but also for the world economy. India has already overtaken France and the UK to be the fifth largest economy in the world. And it's on its way to challenging Germany probably by the end of the decade. And that means, obviously, by definition, along with China, what goes on in those two places is increasingly relevant for world GDP. Now, to the other part of your question, and I think it's a very important issue about poverty in India, a country's economic growth performance is driven by two simple things. One, the number of people that are working, and secondly, their productivity. And yes, India has an enormous demographic dividend, and one of the reasons that drove our BRICS projections, and it still staggers me when I say it because we're in the middle of it still, over the period from, say, 2010 through to 2035, the increase in India's working population will be as much as the whole combined working population of the four largest continental European countries. So that in itself makes it easier for India to grow a lot. If they could boost their productivity more, they could actually grow with those demographics by over 10% a year for the best part of two decades. And that would, of course, accelerate not only India's growth rate, but help to reduce what is still, sadly, a very large number of people living in poverty.
I've got to ask you about the fact that as all these sorts of countries that are part of the BRICS, and there are so many that seem to want to join. Russia supports the arrival of Saudi Arabia, I understand, and Iran, and so on. What do you think they will be discussing when it comes to U.S. Treasury bill exposure? I know in American media they're talking all the time about the debt ceiling, which I don't know whether we can just not talk about it because it's largely a kind of tabloid story, some might say. But U.S. Treasury bill exposure is arguably a more important issue in the Global South, do you think?
Well, it relates to what we touched on a few minutes ago, to be honest. And this in itself would be a sign of the persistence of the dollar. But in order for the dollar to end, there has to be some alternative. And it is quite interesting, as you've just very clearly pointed out, where a lot of the noise about the irritation of the dollar comes from, which is from some of these aspiring BRICS countries. They're the ones that keep buying lots of short-dated US bills. And so they themselves, and here the BRICS group could play a huge role, have to come up with an alternative where investors want to hold their liquidity instead of the US dollar.
How can they, and what would you advise the Chinese government, say, if they wanted to unwind? They have been progressively buying fewer and fewer treasury bills, divesting themselves of it, but they still have $867 billion of official, Japan in the top with $1.1 trillion of US treasury debt. How would you advise it? Because they obviously don't want to destroy their own economies by withdrawing the, by selling off the US debt.
I mean, I do talk to policymakers in some of these countries about these issues, and I have actually published on this quite frequently, and I'd say two things. First of all, it would be nice to see the BRICS political leaders meeting having some real ambition of specific things to achieve other than really just giving symbolic messages. And in that regard, particularly in terms of accepting new members, I think they should ask themselves, what is it a new member is going to bring that we can't achieve without them? And if they start to go through that kind of mental process, then you can start to seriously think about whether the BRICS countries could be at the basis of some new kind of, not only currency, but some new kind of competitor to the US financial system. But if they're not going to do that and have those kind of detailed discussions, then a lot of it is just sort of noise that goes around the financial markets never endingly. The second thing I would say, which is more specific to certain countries, China, as many people have often said correctly, has a very, very large domestic savings rate, which is why it invests so much frequently outside of China. And one way of not having the same need to find things like US Treasury bills or US Treasury bonds so often would be for them to actively reduce their domestic savings ratio, and therefore they'd have less money to invest overseas. And importantly, one of the byproducts of that, I think, would be to encourage an even faster rate of personal consumption rising in China, and that would benefit China's citizens enormously and offset anything they should be worrying about the consequences of not having so many U.S. Treasury bills.
Yeah, some people saying they can't even satisfy their own demand in the next few years in China. Who knows? But what about those who say there are problems in the European Union and the United States that are insurmountable in the face of what's going on in the rest of the world? I don't know why you think, reportedly, Mohammed bin Salman and MBZ here in the United Arab Emirates didn't answer Biden's call to reduce, to increase output and reduce oil prices. Do you think that's symptomatic of what's happening with BRICS power? I know you just said that they need revolutionary decision-making rather than PR, but wasn't that a demonstration of power?
I mean, you know, I'm calling for, I don't think what I'm calling for is revolutionary. It's called focus and trying to have.
I think the Federal Reserve would say it's revolutionary if they announced in South Africa they were going to intend on a massive sell-off of U.S. Treasury bills.
Well, you know, at some point in the future, goes to the reoccurring, in some ways, central theme of our discussion. At some point in the future, those kind of things will happen if the BRICS countries become a bigger share of global GDP, particularly individual ones like China and India. Something like that is going to happen. To be quite candid, I can't imagine the US would be that stressed if South Africa, as a specific case, suddenly announced tomorrow they were going to get rid of their US treasuries, because I don't think they would believe it would be a particularly marginal influence on the price of them. If the whole of the BRICS countries said it together, that obviously would be different.
Just finally, I know you've been increasingly interested in microbial resistance and healthcare. Yeah. And other issues. Julian Assange, who's imprisoned in London, has talked about war as a massive laundromat of money helping weapons companies, a sort of Keynesian militarism. How dangerous our war and in terms of healthcare, people are talking about how the kinds of private healthcare systems that exist are not, and I know you've advocated nationalised systems recently. How important is it for democratic structures to get hold of the financial system in Western Europe and the United States when it comes to healthcare and when it comes to war?
I mean, you're asking me lots of things as part of...
We'll have to have you on again to talk about the resistance to antibiotics.
The whole antibiotic stuff I've done and antimicrobial resistance is probably the most interesting thing I've ever done in my life. And this is why we need to somehow find a global system of governance like the G20 that works. Because if we don't, we are going to end up in the next 20 to 30 years of a world in which we don't have antibiotics that work. And much of how my generation and your generation has lived its life is not going to be able to continue. And these are things that should distinguish between black and white, male and female, or Russia or America. These are things that we have a shared interest in making sure remain in place.
Lord Jim O'Neill, thank you. And that's it for the show. We'll be back with a brand new episode on Saturday, but until then, you can keep in touch via all our social media if it's not censored in your country, and head to our channel, Going Underground TV on rumble.com, to watch new and old episodes of Going Underground. See you Saturday.